Welcome back, everyone, to What the Bark, the Right Paw podcast, to all of our furry and not so furry listeners. This week, we're really excited. We've got another fantastic guest to bring you. Of course, our good friend Genetic George is back. George, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Nathan.
And I know you've been hammering me, Nathan, we need to get a judge. Nathan, we need to get a judge on the podcast. And we have delivered, but we've got so much more than a judge. We've got the lovely Jeanette Loft from Emerald City Cairn Terriers. Really excited to have her along. Yeah, hi, Jeanette.
Hi, yeah, great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, hi, Jeanette. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this one because there's not many things that I need to learn about Nathan in this, you know, career that I've had over 25 years. But
we never stop learning.
Yeah, never stop learning. You thought Jeanette was coming on, and some of the expertise you told me Jeanette had, I'm just so looking forward to it, from temperament to a judge as well and a breeder. Wow, what a combination. But yeah, sounds like it's going to be a really good podcast.
And Jeanette, she's in the midst of it at the moment. She just showed us before the podcast started her gorgeous Cairn Terrier pups. They're just 6 weeks old now.
Yes, getting to that age where they're into everything. So it's really exciting.
Good the fun. Cairn Terrier, did you say? Yes. Well, is yes, the yes. Wizard of Oz, am I right? That's
correct, yes.
And
one photo from the Wizard of Oz, yeah.
And one of my slides that I always have when I talk genetics and diseases was the Cairn Terrier, and the disease in the Cairn Terrier was the first genetic test published and offered in pedigree dogs. Yes, famous for them.
Wow.
And yeah, there you go. The first genetic test published and offered, and don't quote me, I believe it's a factor 6 or 7 disease. I haven't got it at the top of my head, but that was the first published disease associated with the breed, the Cairn Terrier. Famous. Okay. Not only Wizard of Oz, but driving every breeder crazy with genetic testing today because of what was
Yeah, and you know, there's another little fact about them that I thought I must say, having listened to the previous podcasts, and you talked about the royal family. So Queen Victoria, who was the longest reigning monarch we've ever had up until our current, you know, Queen Elizabeth took over that mantle. Mm-hmm. But yes, Queen Victoria had Cairn Terriers. You know, she was very fond of Scotland, and that's where they come from. And if you go to the Queen Victoria building in Sydney, mm-hmm. out the front of it is actually a beautiful statue of a Cairn Terrier surrounded by a fountain. So
you're absolutely right. I walked past that statue God knows how many times in my life, and I knew there was a little dog down there, and I didn't look twice. I was just sort of taken in, but you're absolutely right. It is a Cairn Terrier.
That's right, yeah, because Queen Victoria had them. So, and some of the other royals have as well.
Yes, I think it was Edward.
Yes, oh. Edward.
You know what's going to happen? Everyone's on the internet, on Google.
They're going to be fact-checking us.
You know, they'll be looking it up.
Yeah.
And you know what? It will be a very popular breed in 12 months, and everyone will be wanting to get one.
And, I mean, Jeanette, I'd love to – we always ask this of all of our guests, but would love to hear about – how you started as a breeder and then how you were drawn to the Cairns as well.
As a child, I just loved dogs. I was always following them around. And when I was about 7 or 8, I found a little terrier cross stray in the street and brought it home. And, I've just been involved with dogs ever since then. Once I left home, I then looked into getting a dog of my own. And as a kid, I had read Greyfriars Bobby. So that's, you know, based on a true story about the fellow in Scotland who passed away and his dog wouldn't leave his grave. So the people of Edinburgh would feed the dog while it was still there protecting his owner's grave.
Yes.
Anyway, I think Disney have done a sort of a movie of it or something now.
Well, that's we had Tish Pelchin, Sky Terrier breeder, on the podcast last week, and funnily enough, she did say she it was a bee in her bonnet about how in the book apparently it's a Sky Terrier, but in the Disney film they got a Cairn Terrier to play. It was maybe a bit more glamorous, but so she was quick to remind us that it was a Sky. It was always a Sky.
Yeah, it was. It was a drop-eared Sky. The book that I had as a child, it was the cover was a black and white photograph, and it was sort of a bit of an indeterminate looking terrier. Right.
Yes.
But terriers were something that I was always drawn to. So when I started looking for a dog of my own, I was looking at the Skyes and the Cairns. They were really hard to find, really hard to get. And in the end, I ended up with an Australian Silky Terrier because I thought that they looked a bit like a smaller version of them. So I started out with a Silky. Luckily, I met a wonderful fellow who was the breeder of my Silky, who'd been involved with the breed since the 1950s. And he was in his 80s then and still exhibiting and still having his 5-year breeding plans. And I was studying at university and I ended up taking a part-time job at his kennels. He called me very quaintly his kennel maid, which I think he was an Englishman to start with, and I think that's an English expression.
Yes. I was going to say, it's probably not something you could get away with today.
Yeah, so I was his kennel maid looking after like 40-odd silkies that he had, and he taught me an awful lot about breeding and the health of the dogs, the care of the dogs. We started going to dog shows together, learning about exhibiting, and so for the first 8 years I showed silkies, and then dear old George passed away in his 90s and I'd lost my foundation Silky. So I thought, you know, now I've been to some shows and met some more breeders, it was time for me to start looking at the type of terrier I really wanted. And I did look at the Skye, love the Skye, I've had a Skye, but they often tend to be more of a one person or one family dog. Meeting the Cairn, it just... you know, I just fell in love with them. They're so friendly. They just love everybody. They're so easygoing. You know, down the track I found out that they're, you know, low shedding and quite one of the terriers that's a bit easier to train because they just want to please you so much. And also because they're often really food oriented. So that that really helps with training.
It sort of leads us into this terrier. And I'm going to... We're going to talk temperament terriers, and you know, the terriers, if they were in the dinosaur world, they'd be known as the T-Rex because they are a terrier, aren't they, when you think about it? So can you maybe just give us a temperament that sort of defines terriers? I know you can't put them all into one group. What is it that, why are they a terrier group?
I mean, the first clue is the name, terrier, which, you know, comes from the Latin meaning earth. So there are often dogs that went to earth that were able to, you know, dig or chase things, you know, rabbits and hares and badgers and otters and rats. And they were often dogs that went to ground. Generally I'd say the one sort of uniting characteristic of terriers is their alertness. But look, there is quite a spectrum within the terriers from, you know, your full on, like a kid on red cordial type terrier, you know, which is classically Jack Russell, all the way to the other end of the spectrum where you have a bit more of a laid back type terrier.
And that's right. I see that sometimes. People always think, for example, the Amstaff Terrier is a very laid back terrier. It's almost like a bull breed terrier, which is very, very laid back, you know. There's still a bit of, I don't think the word sort of sits well with us. Everyone sort of hears the word terrier and all the things territorial, you know. We always say terrier with territorial, and that means, you know, don't get in its way, don't grab its ball, don't get another dog next to it. I think it's this perception that we need to change, you know. And everyone has a lovely Boston Terrier, he loves his ball, but he's very gentle, he doesn't bark. And there are some terriers that just bark a lot. Like a Jack Russell. There are some that just don't.
So, that's right. Unless there's a reason.
And I think that it's actually a really good point because, you know, every dog is different. Every dog has their own personality, even though they might fit within a group. And I guess that's sort of the whole point, as you said, of this podcast episode, which is all about temperament. And I guess, you know, for those at home that haven't heard that word before, or, you know, that phrase, what is temperament, Jeanette?
So I think scientifically, and I'm sure George can expand on this, but my understanding is that temperament actually refers to the inherited sort of traits. So, you know, something that they genetically inherit. But a lot of us tend to use the word temperament more broadly so that it then can take in more than inherited traits, so acquired traits, you know, things that come due to environment and socialization and training. And, you know, that takes us to the classic nature versus nurture debate. I mean, I personally think it's a combination of both.
It is.
You know, some dogs, depending on their breed, might be born with a particular slant towards a type of temperament, but then their environment, their socialization and their training can add to that, you know, enhance it, etc. So
and Jeanette, you're completely right. You don't need George to answer that. You've the science behind it is, you know, we tend to think that when you look at temperament, between sort of, you know, some people are anything between 50 to 60, maybe 60 to 70% is breed. You know, it's in that breed. You should have a sound temperament based on the breed you've got. And then the rest of it is all, as you discussed, is environmental. Mm-hmm. You know, socialization.
Yeah. You can context the environment. Temperament.
And, you know, and it's sort of one of the reasons why what sort of separates, you know, pedigree dog breeding from the rest, in that you've got a specific line and temperament. Sometimes you'll see, and I'm pretty sure you do, variation of temperament within that breed. Because of specific lines. It's everyone wants the perfect dog, everyone wants the perfect temperament, but unfortunately you're not going to get it. It's important. I always discuss this with people that sort of carry on about, you know, genetic testing and everything else. Remember, 98% of what you breed becomes someone's pet.
Absolutely.
And that means temperament. You know, it doesn't matter about what disease it's carrying, what it's positive for in if you've got a temperament that just doesn't fit a pet. That's the gist of it. You're breeding a 98%.
Definitely. Happy and healthy.
Mm. Yeah, you know, healthy, but temperament. Sometimes people will sort of focus too much on just making sure every dog's genetically clear, but the temperament might be lousy.
And you don't want to live with a dog like that.
No.
Yes. And how would you, as a breeder and an owner of Cairns, how would you describe the temperament of a Cairn Terrier? What are the types of words that come up? How do you classify temperament?
So as I said before, inherently they just love everybody. They're really sociable, really people dogs. They love being with people. They quite like being with other dogs as well. They tend to like bigger dogs more than small dogs. And like I said, they want to please you. They are often very food-oriented, so I find them fairly easy to train. They're really just an old-fashioned Scottish working dog, and so like most working breeds, you know, they're quite intelligent, too smart for their own good sometimes.
You know what I find, Nathan, every time we have a guest on and they talk about their breed, they always tell me how great their breed. It's interesting. Everyone seems, there's always really nice things about everyone's breed and what comes out about it. And, you know, what Jeanette's saying is it makes me want to go out and get a Cairn Terrier tomorrow. Previously it was a Chow Chow. So there's all, you can see why people are attracted to specific dogs. They have this particular temperament that suits them. Jeanette, I'm going to get straight to it. Every time I have a podcast, I tell my son about, you know, who I've got on. He always asks me the Dion question, which is my young son. And the question he's asked me today, which isn't on the, I just want to get out of the way because it's burning me as well. I've been thinking about it all night. How do you as a judge, a ring, assess temperament? How, you know, we're talking about how important it is.
Yes.
Yet you're judging based on the phenotype of that dog, and within that time, how does temperament fit into what you're looking at?
So a lot of the breed standards include something about temperament. You know, so they'll say this dog should be, you know, alert and approachable, friendly. You know, others might be wary. So, you know, you should bear that in mind when you're judging that particular breed, what their breed standard says about the type of temperament that they should exhibit. So really, I mean, you can watch them from the moment they walk in the ring, the way you approach them, how they react to that. With terriers, it's a little bit easier because, and it goes with all dogs to some extent, but really with terriers, you know, you're looking at their eyes, their ears, and their tail.
Okay.
So the carriage of the tail, the carriage of the ears, you know, what they're looking at, That's really a classic way of getting an idea of the terrier temperament. And as I said, most of them, you want them, you know, alert and outgoing. I can't think of any terrier breed standard that says shy and withdrawn.
Okay. But is there any, there are some that obviously are from what you're saying. So when you judge them, they're going to be a bit more anxious and a bit more reserved. Is that right? There are some breeds that do exhibit that
temperament? Yeah, or just an individual dog that perhaps it's their first show, or maybe they, you know, have had a scare just before they came into the ring. If I saw a dog that had a really good breed type and it shied away from me, say, I would give it every opportunity to show itself, you know, like go and stand on the other side of the ring, tell the owner to get the most out of it, you know, and so it might, owner might pull out some food or a squeaky toy or something and, get the dog to then exhibit its normal personality.
I've had a look at cat shows and they tend to do that very, very well, you know, where the judge will get toy and play and lift them up and pick them up and really focus on just their temperament as well. But, you know, when you're at a dog show, I didn't realise that you can use all those tools. And So tail, ears. Can I ask you, do you ever sort of grab the dog on a lead and look at it yourself, take it away from the owner? Is that something a judge can do?
I guess they could, but I certainly wouldn't do that.
Okay. Another interesting question I've got for you from the Dean on Thought is, how many times do you see the temperament of the dog reflect the temperament of the owner?
Yeah, sometimes. Well, they say that about, you know, looks as well, don't they?
Yes. Yeah. Okay, that's right.
We end up looking like our dogs.
Well, it's interesting because we spoke about microchipping a few weeks ago, and I remember I'd go to microchipping days and they'd put the puppy down and the owner would go, oh, just watch it, it might not like the microchipping. And it was almost when they sort of implanted the chip, the dog would sort of carry on, but it was almost like the owner was doing that beforehand.
So it was picking up on the vibes of
the vibes on
person.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, in dog showing, they've got a saying about how you feel travels down the lead to your dog. And so obviously
they're very
perceptive.
If you're
stressed or anxious or angry, you know, the dog will definitely pick up on that.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it's interesting. It's almost like, so you've got the groups themselves have their own temperament. So your terriers or your gun dogs or your, you know, they'll all have their own temperament, hounds. And then I guess one layer below that is each individual breed within that group will sort of, I guess, inherit a part of that, but then also will have their own sort of individual characteristics. So there's a few layers to it to work through. And you've got to be aware of almost all of them as a judge, I guess. Do you have to brush up on the temperaments beforehand, like just to, you know, depending on what you're breeding? Like it's a lot of information to retain in your head.
It is a lot, yeah, definitely. I always like to go through the breed standards and make sure I'm familiar with them again before I judge some dogs. So, yeah, definitely. All breeds judges have an incredible job. I mean, there's no way that they can remember every single nuance of every single breed, you know, 200 plus breeds or something. So I guess they tend to have a few particular characteristics of that breed that they might remember as being unique to that breed. And so that's sort of what they tend to use. And that's your difference then between your all breeds judges and your specialist judges.
And Jeanette, just remind me, are you a specialist or an all breeds judge?
I am a terrier judge. Cairns, obviously, and been lucky enough to judge those in a number of countries around the world. I've been studying my toy judge license as well. I don't know if you know, but Silky Terriers are in the toy group here in Australia, whereas in other countries they are in the terrier group. So, but here in Australia they're a toy breed, and I like the toys, so I've been studying that as well. But thanks to our friend COVID, that's been put on hold for a while. So
that's okay. You can still tell us what. Give me the nicest place you've travelled to.
I was lucky enough to judge in St. Petersburg in Russia, and that was absolutely incredible. St. Petersburg is just beautiful. Yeah. But then I've also judged in Finland, and there's lots of gorgeous places in Finland as well. So
people don't realise the amount of dogs that are actually bred in Russia, and
just
the quality of them. The quality is
definitely I look
at some of the pedigrees there, and I see, you know, Ukraine, Russian.
It's huge. It's
huge. People and cats as well. Let me tell you some of the cat breeds that have come out of Russia. So you know, we said don't sort of tend to think about it, but see, lovely St. Petersburg in Finland. See, that's one of the perks of being an international specialist judge, Jeanette. And you know what? They treat you like royalty.
it's a great way to travel, you know, to go to some shows or meet up with other dog people that you've met online before or at international shows, and you end up becoming friends. And
it's been hard getting there. Don't let anyone think it's been easy work to become an international specialist. The amount of research you've had to do, work you've had to do, I'm sure it's taken you. So how did you get, can I ask you, how do you start? What is it, if I want to get into judging, how do you get about, how do I start?
I think it's slightly different across the states. In New South Wales, where I am, you have to start out with a sort of, I think it's a members education course. And once you complete that, you can then, if you pass all the other criteria, so, you know, you have to have bred so many litters, you have to have shown so many dogs to become champions, you have to have been a member for X amount of years, all these sort of criteria. Once you meet all of that, you can apply to join the judges training scheme. And then that's, you know, a couple of years of your life to say goodbye to.
So, Nathan, perfect for you. I'm past all that. You're at that age where you could easily become an international specialist judge, travel all over the world. I'm too old for that.
Oh, I've got to start from the ground up. I've got to breed, then show, champions, then judging. So there's a few hurdles to climb.
And Jeanette hasn't even mentioned just the challenges of just in the dog world at just showing and trying to win. And that's another thing. And then, you know, good luck. just interesting. Has there been any judging done via Zoom now with COVID? Have you had shows that people have thought about doing online shows? Is that something that...
When we had the lockdown last year the first time, there were some Zoom shows, but they were done for charity or fun because they weren't sanctioned shows. They weren't
It'd be so difficult
shows that you
to,
could, you know, get points at or anything like that.
I mean, assessing things like temperament over Zoom would be, gosh, so difficult to get a real, I guess, feel of the dog.
That's right. And, I mean, part of the assessment of the dog's conformation is putting your hands on it, you know. You actually physically feel the shape of the skull or the, you know, how the ribs are set, the tail set, the musculature of the dog. You look in their mouth and see what their bite is like. So that's very hard over Zoom, obviously.
Yes. Well, there goes that business of setting up the Zoom.
I've seen a lot of shows live stream, though. I've seen a lot, like that's quite nice. But Jeanette, something I'm really interested in is, you know, does temperament change over time? Like I know, like, you know, puppies obviously develop a personality with the breeder and then obviously they'll go to their new homes. But is the personality of the pup pretty well entrenched, you know, by that sort of first 6 to 8 weeks? Or can a puppy's personality change over time?
I mean, I think, again, you know, that is sort of that nature versus nurture discussion. I don't think it's entrenched in that you can't enhance a puppy's personality. So if you get a puppy that, you know, likes you, but it's actually a bit sort of reserved, a little bit shy, with ongoing socialization and training, I believe that you would be able to make that puppy more outgoing. Yes. So I'm not saying that sort of part of their personality is entrenched. There's been dogs that have been more angry, aggro, that people have been successfully able to train to be better behaved dogs, not exhibit anger. I'm not really familiar with that because cans, like I said, just tend to like everybody.
Yeah, the old can. I'm going to tell you, I'll give you some. As you get older, you get angrier. You can't tell me, I don't care what anyone says. But every time I go and see my dad, every week he seems to be just, this is happening. And I see it in older dogs. You know, when you walk in, they just want to be left alone. They've done their time.
Yes.
You know, as far
that's as
true,
I'm, as they
they've
age.
Done their time. They've done all their running around at a park and hassling dogs. I sometimes see them, and, you know, especially when a younger, you know, dog comes up to them and have, they just sort of turn and go, all right, get out of here. You know, I can just see it in their face. So I think as you get older, you just, you do get a bit grumpier, and maybe dogs as well. That's a good question. What is the oldest dog that you've awarded a champion to?
I think I judged a veteran class and...
What, they have a veterans class?
Wow.
Some shows do, yeah. Usually the specialist, like single breed shows.
What defines a veteran? Like what age bracket?
In New South Wales, there's two age brackets, veterans 7 to 10, and then almost 10, and then 10 and over.
Oh, so I'd love to see a 10 and over. It's a pensioner class. That's amazing. You've got like a pensioner's class, 10 and
absolutely,
over.
Absolutely, yeah.
And do they sort of have like, do any of them come out with like one leg? Sorry, I interrupted you.
I've seen some really dear, doddery old ones. Very brave faces. And look, the crowd usually loves it, you know. Who doesn't love an oldie? I mean, they're beautiful.
I love them. Yeah, there's, like I said, there's something about them. The way they can just look at a dog and just go, look, don't hassle me. And, you know, they're the only dog I think when you get to that age, you can even go, you know what, I'll take you off the lead for a while. I'll walk you off the lead because, you know, they just need to take their time where they leave their messages and where they've been and sort of sit back and reminisce. I remember I used to rule this footpath in my good old younger days. Sorry, I'm sounding like an old retired. What did you call it again? Veterans class. I must try and...
I'm gonna start, see if I can slip that into every podcast now.
George's veterans class.
Welcome, George, from the veteran class.
Thank you. I think anyone out there that wants show sponsorship from Orivet for a veterans class, reach out to me, please. I want forget these specialty shows, and I want to sponsor some of these veterans classes. Although, to be honest, they'll be too old to genetically test. But hey, we can pass it on to their, you know, the kids and whatever. Interesting. That's very so. Sorry, I interrupted. The oldest winner you've awarded to was?
I think I remember a dear daughtery old 16-year-old or something. So,
wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. Wow. And I had some lovely news a couple of days ago. The owners in Sydney contacted me to let me know a brother and sister that I bred had just had their 17th birthday.
That's amazing.
Yeah, fantastic.
Gosh, that is a great thing about the terriers is that they do have the ability to live a very long, happy and healthy life.
That's right. Yeah
very old, grumpy.
I mean, one of the things, George, you might not know about Jeanette is that Jeanette also matches her owners and pups using something called temperament testing, which I found out about. I mean, side note, Cairn Terriers, I love them as well, and one day would love to have a Cairn Terrier. And when I got to know Jeanette a little bit more, she told us all about how she runs for all of her sort of, I guess, new litters, a temperament testing process to try and understand the temperament of the pups and then, you know, I guess try to match them with the new owners. And Jeanette would love to hear about how you run that process. How do you assess and how do you match with the new dog?
Sure. Yeah, it's something that we've been doing for each litter for a long time. So we use the Volhard puppy assessment test or temperament assessment test that's been around for a number of decades. But and it tests things like social attraction, following people, how they react to restraint, their level of social dominance, elevation dominance, which is how they feel when they're sort of held above the ground, retrieving. Generally, my puppies don't do so well at that one. They're not retrievers. Some have gone on to become retrievers, their families have told me, but it's rare. Mm. Touch sensitivity, sound sensitivity, so that's, you know, you make a loud noise near them and see how they react. Sight sensitivity, you know, throwing something past them, seeing how they react. You know, they're not sight hounds. They're not going to run after it necessarily, but some are interested in it. Stability. For the stability test, you open an umbrella and place it near the puppy. which is generally something that they've never seen before. So it's like, how do they react if they encounter something new?
A foreign object.
Exactly, yeah. So how we like to do it is get as many of the puppy families for that litter to come along as possible. This way of doing it is really useful. Number one, because everybody gets to see how the puppies react. And number two, me as a breeder, I get to see what the families are like.
Yes.
And to me, that's just as important. You know, I've already built up an opinion of the puppies because I've spent 6 or 7 weeks watching them, playing with them, socialising them. So I already know a fair bit about them. But the assessment test helps me get to know my puppy families a bit more and see how they react. You know, are they a bit scared of touching a puppy? Are they, have they got, you know, a pack of boisterous kids? That's really useful. So I think temperament assessments to me have a dual purpose and it's been really helpful.
Clever. They think you're assessing the pup.
Yeah.
They're really the ones under the mic. Now.
Yeah. Okay. It's important, you know, because in the end, you know, not every breed can suit that person or that environment.
Right.
They all sometimes, you know, people are just making an impulsive decision. But really, you know, there's probably another breed they need if there's, you know, I totally agree. Some people just it doesn't suit their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the reason why most dogs end up in rescues or pounds, it's because the dog doesn't suit that person's lifestyle. They initially thought it would, and the work that's required and what's, you know, and, you know, the amount of exercise it needs just doesn't work for them. So it's actually...
That's right. And certainly we've had families who have said, we want this puppy, you know, pointing out a particular one because they like its colouring or it just happened to be the first one that ran up to them or something. Mm. And if we think that that's not going to be a good match for them, you know, we'll let them know.
Yeah.
And so...
be a tough conversation, I can imagine, sometimes.
It is, yeah. I recall a dad he had his two little girls there and he was definite that he really wanted this particular dog. So, you know, Peter and I sort of sat his girls down and said, okay, well... this is the one you want. We put that puppy in her lap and it did a quick squirm, jumped off and ran away. And then I said, this is the one that we would recommend for your family. Put another puppy in his daughter's lap. Mm. She started cuddling it. It just melted into her and they stayed cuddling for ages. And he went, yeah, okay. And next thing you know, we're getting pictures of this dog dressed in doll's clothes, getting pushed around in the pram
tortured.
It was perfect.
It was a perfect fit. Yeah. Personality is what you live with. Yeah, I mean, temperament is what you live with every day. You know, and that's what's going to be the most important thing above all else. You know, when you're starting your puppy search, researching the breed, understanding the breed, but then even then you've got to look and get to that puppy level and make sure that you're getting matched with the right owner. That's why I love the temperament testing. I think it's such a fantastic way. And to bring the owners in. And I saw actually recently, Jeanette, you did one live stream. You did it over Facebook Live, I think, as well.
Yes. Yeah, I try and live stream for people who can't get here. Mind you, I've had people come over from Perth to where we are in the Canberra region to attend a puppy temperament test, so they were pretty keen. But yeah, live streaming, it might give you a bit of an idea at least anyway.
And in terms of the temperament testing, you run it around sort of how old do the pups sort of need to be?
6 to 7 weeks, yeah. Okay. 7 weeks is ideal according to Volhard's instructions. But, you know, we have to look at when we're available, when the puppy families are available and do our best, yeah. But 6 to 7 weeks is a really good sort of indication usually.
And if I've got a dog at home, you know, if I'm a dog owner and I want to try and understand, you know, what temperament does my dog have? You know, how could I go about doing that? Obviously, I might not be able to run through the whole Volhard's standard, or maybe I can. You know, how can I assess my dog's temperament at home?
I mean, yeah, you could you'd need to find someone the dog doesn't know to do each of the tests with them. But in terms of temperament, obviously what you're seeing at 6 to 7 weeks is what they've been born with. What you're seeing for your older dog who's lived with you for a while is their genetic temperament as well as what they have since learned. You know, so you've had a big part in that, obviously. So if you don't like their temperament, then, well, maybe you need to do
it's
something
on you.
About it.
That's
right. Yeah. Well, they say you're the sum of the five or six people you spend the most time with. So I guess that maybe that goes for dogs as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you must have seen that dogs often pick up off their owners. Yeah.
I didn't leave Charlie enough with other people when he was too young. So when we go away, he's just all anxious. So I have to have someone who stays at our place just to make sure his environment. And that's probably
really?
Something that I just didn't leave him at other places at that early age. He was always, you know, when you get a puppy, you're always with them. You always take them everywhere they go, but you don't think about what happens when you're actually going to go away and the dogs that'll be left without you. So this anxiety.
But you're owning up that was something that you sort
that
of
we caused. Did, you know. Yeah. Jeanette, everyone has a PhD in hindsight. And if only I had of. But this is what I always argue. There's, you know, you can't go back and change. That's hardwired in there. You can help by leaving radios on and making sure you can't come back and people stay in your home. But, you know, it's somehow you just can't change. You know, he sees the suitcases coming out and he knows it's an overseas trip. He sees a bag, he knows it's a weekend trip. So his hair starts to drop off and he'd be, no, I'm only joking about that. But you know, he gets into this real sort of anxiety buildup about him.
Yeah, and then it's all about, the amount of, I guess, time and effort that you've got to put in to try and address those behaviours and almost, rewire them. And that's, I think, what a lot of new owners have to work hard on to sort of set that standard early, because it can, you know, once it's sort of been hardwired in for a while, it can take a while to undo, unlearn.
Sure. Yeah. You know, but there is, as we were talking about earlier, there is a part of their temperament that comes from their breed.
Yes.
So I'll give you an example. When I changed from Silky Terriers to Cairn Terriers, the first time we went on holidays and left our Cairn in the care of someone else, I was sort of like, oh, it's sad, you know, they're going to miss me and I'll miss them. The Cairns don't. They just like, see ya. Hi, new person, perfectly happy, not stressed at all. Okay. I was used to Silky Terriers who tend to be more of a one person or a one family dog. And when I went away, just like George was saying about his Boston, the Silkies would fret. They would not eat. You know, I'd come back and they'd be thin and it was, I mean, it made it hard for me to enjoy my holidays when they were like this. So all of a sudden I changed to Cairns and I saw that, like, I walked out the door and they didn't give me a second look. And I'm like, oh, they don't really love me. They don't care. And then I went, hang on, Jeanette, remember how difficult it was to deal with a dog personality or temperament that was so incredibly attached to you. Be happy that you've now got these dogs that just love everybody. Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, I work in rescue as well, and I've rehomed 8-year-old Cairn Terriers who, like, the next day it's like they've always lived with this new family. Not a problem, because they are very much people-oriented. So, you know, there is a bit of that sort of temperament that is hardwired, that they have, you know, it's wired into their genetics that they've inherited. But then I still believe, you can train, you can socialise, you know, you can do a lot of things to help the dog become part of your lifestyle that you enjoy.
And I will say that when it comes to a breed, that if you have to rank as having the best temperament, and I know you're talking Cairns, whatever, worldwide, the Labrador is literally the gold standard when you look at it as temperament and what you're able to do. You know, they make really good working dogs and guide dogs. They make really good family dogs too. You know, there's literally not one bit of terrier or you know anything about them. Really nice breed, and that's why they are number one pretty much everywhere. America, they're number one. Australia, they're still number one. UK, they're number one. So, and they're a popular family dog. Yeah,
very amiable.
Yeah, they are. Shout out to the Labrador.
And so, Jeanette, something we ask of every breeder that comes on is, you know, we've got a lot of breeders and owners that listen to the podcast. And if there was one message that you could share with them, you know, that you'd love to, you know, put on a billboard and shout to every, you know, breeder and owner, you know, what would be your message that you'd love to, you know, to tell those owners and breeders?
To breeders, it's about producing the best dog that you can in terms of health and temperament. Don't let anything else get in the way of that, you know. I think it does sometimes, and it might depend on what people's goals are, you know, in their breeding. But I say focus on health and temperament. To owners, do your research beforehand. You know, go along to a dog show and meet all different types of breeds. Talk to the breeders. Most breeders will be upfront with you and tell you the pros and cons of their breed, you know, because they don't want to fool anyone. They want you to know, okay, these are the great parts, but you also have to put up with the perhaps not so great parts. So do your research, because having a dog as a companion, as part of your family in your life, is a long-term decision. And therefore, you want to try and get it right.
Yeah.
So that means doing your research, taking your time, talking to different people, research online. And sometimes it means waiting. You know, I know it's exciting to get a new puppy, but it won't always be available immediately. And if it's the right puppy for you, it's worth waiting for.
And that's well said, Jeanette, because it's exactly when people ring me up, I go to a dog show. If you're interested in that breed, go and to the dog show,
have a look,
talk to some breeders, chat to them, yes, and see what you want and see whether it does fit. You know, I get a lot of my friends, because I'm in this industry, oh, George, can you help me out with this thing? I go, before I can help you with any breed, go to a dog show, have a look, chat to all the breeders, and you'll find, and it sort of, it also moves you up the list, if you know what I mean. If you met a few breeders and you're chatting to them, and the breeders sort of warm to you based on they've been able to at least screen you, or go onto the right portal and let them screen for you. Exactly. Use it as a way to allow you to make the decision and make sure the breeder that you're choosing is correct for you. I couldn't agree more. Go to a dog show.
Yeah, go to a dog show, meet the breeder, and just do your best to build that relationship with the breeder as well, because, yeah, as you said, that's what it comes down to, you know, being showing that you're engaged and showing that you really, really want to bring that dog into your life as well. Brilliant. So I think, George, have you got everyone's favourite segment?
Oh, yes, Jeanette, this is the part that everyone waits for where, you know, it's probably... You know, I know the session has been educational, but this is really the real part we all wait for to throw some Latin or Greek words that George can't get his work.
And considering that the CAN is the first published, you know, genetic test, it only makes sense that we ask Jeanette to choose at random a number between 1 and 200. And every week we then look it up in George's fantastic DNA Bible. And we find out what we're going to learn about.
I'm buying this 1 to 200 because I'm including an index in this, and I've just been thinking about this, and I overthought if anyone picked 198, I'd be just reading an index. So I apologise. It's from 1 to 161 is what it is, Jeanette. So, yeah, pick a random number.
137.
That was very specific.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. The amount of trophies that... Jeanette.
Yeah, the amount of ribbons that we can see behind her, which our audience can't see, but they're all pitched up on the wall behind Jeanette.
Well, you've chosen retinal dysplasia, which is one of our eye conditions, and it is good news in that it's something that we do offer for the Labrador Retriever as a genetic test. It does affect a number of breeds. Of course, it's the retina, it's the layer of the retina or tissue at the back of the eye that includes and supports the photoreceptors that detect lights. Good news is it's a word I can pronounce. I haven't got anything going for
no lesson.
Syllables, yeah. Common results in folds in the retina, which causes blind spots in the dog's field of vision. This is the mildest form of the disease, and it is generally thought that a dog will not even notice small blind spots. Some dogs may have multiple folds, which results in blindness. It's an inherited disorder, so it's recessive, so you must pass it on from two parents. And occurs and can occur, although less commonly, due to a viral infection or toxins and certain drugs or trauma. Develops about 12 to 16 weeks of age and can only be diagnosed by an ophthalmologic veterinarian. And seen in most breeds, it sort of impacts, as it says there, the colour. And screening is around about 4 months of age and every 2 years after that. So, yeah, affects quite a number of breeds, so many breeds that I have to go across to the other page. I'll see if the anterior is listed there for you. No, it looks like another bugger, another positive thing of the Canterrier. Not many diseases.
They're a pretty hardy breed, the Cairns.
They are. Well done, well chosen. So thank you, Jeanette. It's retinal dysplasia for this episode.
Okay.
But no, that's brilliant. And Jeanette, what I'd love to do is I'll put in our notes a link to the live temperament testing that you did a little while back so that people who are really interested to see how it works can go back and watch and get a feel for it. And I'll also include a link to the Volhard method as well so people can learn a little bit more. But thank you so much for joining us. I feel like I've learned so much, and I'm going to go back and now every dog that I see now on the street, I'm going to be watching and be observing, be trying to do my own little side judging as I try and determine their temperaments as I go.
And exactly. Jeanette, you've taught me a few things. I've now got the word kennel made. I think I'm going to use. Yes. And I'm definitely going to try and get out to see a veterans class.
Veterans class.
In fact, I'm going to go there with my walking stick and little wheelchair. Oh, it's going to be sensational. I've really enjoyed it, Jeanette. You've sort of given me, and like Nathan said, next time I'm going to look at a dog, I'll see just temperament and owner's temperament, just as important.
Yes.
You know, how they manage their dog, and is their dog reflecting temperament that is really much coming, the owner is as well. Interesting. No, it's been good.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, Jeanette, and it was great to have you on.
Yeah,
thanks,
good Jeanette. To meet you, George, and thank you very much, Nathan.
Thank you.
Pleasure.